Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What's more important, the information and knowledge we put into our heads or the ability to retrieve it so we can use it effectively? Typically, we have always learned by taking in information from lecture or text, then being tested to see how much we know. According to a new book, there is a flaw in that process because authors contend that what is important is durable learning, remembering what has been taught. The book is titled Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. It reflects research conducted at our own Washington University and promotes a strategy called retrieval practice. Co-author Roddy Roediger is professor of psychology at WashU and joins us in studio. Also with us is Patrice Bain, a social studies teacher at the Columbia, Illinois Middle School, who is an advocate for and has implemented the strategies outlined in that book. Later, we'll talk with one of her students. Thank you, folks, so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Professor, let me begin with you. If you can go into a little more detail than I did in the introduction, what has the science of learning taught you?
I think the science of learning is very important. We've learned a lot in the last 40 years, and it's just now permeating out from the academic ranks of the universities to students around the world and to teachers, too, or at least we hope it is. So one of the things we discovered was, and it's actually a relatively old finding in psychology, it's been rediscovered, is that the act of taking a test, of retrieving information, if I ask you to produce something, that actually helps you learn it much better than if you simply reread it again. Yet, when we ask our students in surveys how even Washington University students and all many other schools have now done these surveys too, how do they prepare for a test? What do they do to learn? Often they say they reread their notes. They underline or highlight their textbooks. They reread that. They reread their class notes, and they believe they're mastering the subject when, in fact, they're gaining great fluency with it, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll be able to produce it when they're asked to on a test. So if you actually give people practice retrieving information from memory, retrieval practice, as you said, that turns out to be much more effective in the long term in maintaining things. If you read stuff over and over, it helps you in the short term, like cramming. It'll get you through the test the next day, but you won't know the material a week or a month later.
Well, what exactly is retrieval practice?
Just exactly what it sounds like. You practice getting information out of memory. So if I, to take simple examples, if I ask you, do you know the first five presidents of the United States, and you produce Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, that's retrieval practice. You've just practiced getting the information out of memory. And that's a simple example. But to the extent that you do this, imagine reading a textbook or imagine reading our book, Make It Stick, and then just after every couple of pages, just closing the book and say, what did I just learn? Repeat it back to yourself, retrieve it. So if you have a heading in the book, say, what is the spacing effect, which we could talk about in a moment, close the book and say, okay, what did I just learn? How could I apply that to myself? You need to reflect on the information and retrieve the information, and that will help you remember it much better later on than simply reading ahead, as we normally tend to do.
It used to be in this country and others that students were taught to learn by rote. This is certainly different than that.
We aim for it to be different. That we're often confused with promoting rote learning, the idea that mindless repetition is what you need. We're hoping that the retrieval practice is, yes, you do need to retrieve the information, but then the idea is to reflect on it, to elaborate on it, to connect it with what you already know, and that way it'll more firmly embed it in your memory and make it easier to retrieve later. So just as we normally focus on getting information into memory, as you said in your introduction, we also need to work on being able to access it and use it at the point that we need it.
Well, keeping it there is certainly something that you want to do. Is there a long-term memory issue or long-term memory enhanced by this process?
Yes, it is. We find, for example, if you repeatedly read something versus imagine reading a passage and then taking a test on it, just taking a blank sheet of paper and trying to retrieve everything you can, recall it all, write it down, and then think about it. In the short term, repeated reading is just fine, that if you're taking a test 5 minutes after the experience. But when we test people 2 weeks or a month or 6 weeks later. In some of the studies we've done at Columbia Middle School, we even tested middle schoolers at the end of the school year. We showed that if they've retrieved the information, if they practice retrieval a few times, they know it at the end of the school year. If they simply reread it a few times, they know it less well.
Now, if I understand correctly what I've read about this whole process, part of the process is to give periodic quizzes, and it's not necessarily for grading purposes. It's really to help students retrieve this information.
Right. That's exactly correct. We sometimes call our idea test-enhanced learning, but the word test is kind of a four-letter word in education these days, and because of standardized tests, of teaching to the test, and so we don't want our program to be confused with that. The idea of quizzing is we make it very low stakes. Sometimes it doesn't count for a grade at all, and Patrice will tell you, I believe, that her middle school classes tend to like it because it breaks up the classroom and they get to practice what they know. And certainly I use it myself now in my college classes. I give a quiz or an assignment every class period, which is unusual at the university level, but it really works. And the other thing it does at the university level, of course, is we sometimes have problems with student attendance or paying attention during class. They have their computers open. How do we know they're not doing Facebook or email or whatever else? Well, if they know they're going to have a quiz at the end of the class on the material I just lectured on and I keep it being interactive, then they're paying attention. They come to class and they're more focused.
Does this process apply only to learning, or can it be used to enhance memory for other things, like where did I leave my car keys?
Yes, you could. I mean, I tell people when they ask me the car keys, well, A, try to put them in the same place every day, and then B, if you put them in a place that you don't usually put them, sit there and reflect on that. Remind yourself what you're doing with this. So that's one thing. But the other one thing people often complain about when they get older is not remembering faces and names as well. They'll know the person, but they won't be able to come up with the name. And I say, well, that's because you never practiced doing that. You didn't have to when you were a kid, but as you become an older adult, if you simply had pictures, which are easier and easier to get, and you just use them like flashcards, have the face on one side, the name on the other, then you can practice retrieving. So practicing getting the information that you know out of memory is something older adults complain about, and retrieval practice helps solve that problem too when you can figure out how to do it.
It is odd, isn't it, that when you lose those car keys, you always find them the last place you look?
Yes.
Patrice, let me turn to you and pick up on some of the things the professor has said with regard to teaching and how you use it. Number one, how did you become interested in this whole process?
Well, it was a chance meeting. I have always taught in a way that I thought was based on the way this book is, and I happened to meet Mark McDaniel, who was also a co-author, and he was about to do a study on how people learn. And as we talked, I saw so many similarities between what he was wanting to do and the way I taught, and the rest is history.
Right. Well, how do you apply it? Specifically, how have you applied it? Have you been doing it for just this past year?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Gosh, maybe.
7 or 8 years.
Yeah,
oh, really?
7 or 8 uh-huh. years.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me how you apply the process in class and how the youngsters are reacting to it.
Okay. What I do is I will do a lecture. I will do some teaching. I try to be very interactive. And then I quiz the students. I quiz them often. I might do a quiz at the end of the class. In fact, one of my favorite ways is if they have an assignment, I will just simply take the assignment and cut it up into paper, into little slips, and put it in a basket. And when they come in the next day, I will just pull out a couple slips of paper as a short little quiz and let them answer the questions. I will do that for a couple days, and then it goes into a larger basket. So I will not only be quizzing them on what we are currently learning, but on what we had learned before as well. So that gets into the spacing effect that Dr. Roediger will probably get into.
Let's get to that right now because it's come up twice, and I don't want people to be wondering much longer.
The basic idea of the spacing effect is simply that if you imagine you get two times to study information, and you're asked, well, so if I've studied it once, what's the best time for me to study it again? And we find that people have a common misconception that, well, if something is strong in memory, the best time for me to restudy it is while it's strong. Let's really nail it and get it in there. Turns out to be exactly backwards advice. The best thing to do, actually, studies have shown this for over 100 years now, very consistently, is to give some time, let some time to pass, to study it once, then let time go by. You probably have some forgetting in there, but actually it turns out that not having the information be so strong in memory actually helps the second presentation. You'll remember something better much later if you have spaced presentations of material. You have time in between, and generally speaking, the more the better, although it depends on the material. So it'd be better if you go read a chapter twice to read it once, then don't read it right away, but wait a week or two and then read the chapter again. And then if you're tested, say, a month later, you'll remember it much better with spaced presentation.
There certainly is a counterintuitive element to all of this, it would seem to me.
Yes, both the so-called testing effect, the idea that taking a test and forcing yourself to retrieve from memory is better than reading. That's hard for some people to accept, but it's been documented very well now, both in classroom situations and in laboratory situations. And the spacing effect is the same way. One time I was invited to a marketing class when I taught at Purdue University, and I asked them, they often measure memory of ads for radio and TV. So I'd ask them, why companies buy ads in the same 60-second time block? So if you have a 15-second ad in the Super Bowl, and then you go show that same 15-second ad again, why do you do it in the same, almost back-to-back? And they said, oh, well, we have the theory that if you've studied something once and it's really strong in memory, the best way to make it even stronger is to do it again right away. And I told them, well, sorry, but if you look at the research evidence, you've got it exactly backwards. You'd be better off to space it, you know, have one at the beginning of the Super Bowl and another ad in the middle or the end. So that's the spacing effect, and it's generally applicable in most every kind of domain it's been studied in.
Well, we have to take a break now. It's fascinating stuff. You've just been listening to Professor Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University and co-author of Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning, and that's what we're talking about today. Also with me in studio is Patrice Bain, social studies teacher at Columbia, Illinois Middle School. We'll come back and continue this conversation and also bring in one of Patrice's students, and we'll pick up on where we just left off. Stay with us. If you'd like to get into the conversation, we'd love to have you. Do you have a system for retrieving information? What would work for you, given what you've been hearing so far in this program? We'd like to hear from you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or give us a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment with Professor Roediger and Patrice Bain. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. With me in studio is Patrice Bain, social studies teacher at Columbia, Illinois Middle School. She uses the technique that we're talking about today called retrieval practice. Also with us is Professor Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University. He is co-author of Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. In a moment, we'll bring in student Zohaina from Columbia, Illinois Middle School. But first, I want to go back to you, Patrice, because you wanted to pick up on something that the professor had just said about spacing.
Yes. I think there is not a teacher anywhere who has not had the experience where they bring something up and the students give a deer in the headlights, like, look, like they've never heard it before. Yet you absolutely know it was taught the previous year. And many of the textbook companies will do something called spiraling. But what happens is they will touch base on a subject and then try to hit it again the following year. But the students don't interact with that information. So what Dr. Roediger was saying was by doing some spacing and doing some retrieval practice in between when they're first taught it and then the following year, students would retain so much more of that information. It wouldn't be starting over every time.
Well, you know, here again is the counterintuitive aspect that I mentioned a moment ago, because we're going through a kind of an enforced spacing process right now with summer vacations. And I've always heard that part of the problem for teachers is the kids come back to school and you've got to kind of reteach them a lot of the things that they were learning before vacation.
Correct.
Well, according to what you're saying, this spacing should be effective, but they seem to forget. That's because they're not using the proper retrieval methods?
Exactly. If there was a way to do some kind of, if teachers had some kind of games or flashcards or different things that students could use over the summer, they would really be farther ahead of the game come September.
All right. Well, let's ask Zoe Hena, who is one of your students at the middle school over in Columbia, who has just graduated from the eighth grade, starting high school now. Zoe, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think about this whole summer vacation thing and retaining all the things that you've learned in the past year or so?
Well, I mean, I'm usually, whenever I come back to school, you know, it's kind of like, man, am I going to remember everything? When they start reviewing it a little bit more and touching base, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, now I remember it. Now I'm starting to get touch base with it. And so, you know, they don't really review so much, just enough to where you can remember it. And then they start fresh and new. So the whole reviewing thing, it helps a lot for the kids, you know, because a lot of kids don't really do much during the summer and kind of just lounge around during the whole time. And, you know, I sometimes like to, you know, sometimes go through my old folders and read through some old stuff so I can come a little bit prepared sometime for school starting. So,
Professor, is she doing the right thing?
Yes. Well, certainly the review is the right thing. Summer vacation is an interesting concept because not every country has it. And the United States, it really started because when schooling became mandatory, the society was very agrarian, so we had to give summers off so that children could help their parents working in the fields. And I think it's safe to say this isn't quite as common today as it once was. So there has been talk of trying to extend the school year, as is done in Japan and a few other countries. But so far it hasn't made any headway here. But it would be good if there could just be refreshers of some sort during the long summer months, because certainly I had the experience when I was a child, and just the same as those, that, boy, it's a long 3 or 4 months in there to retain all that information, especially in a subject like math, where you really need to know what you learned in sixth grade when you get to seventh grade, whereas in history you might be studying a history of a different part of the world, so that might not be as much a stepping stone, but certainly for things like English grammar and mathematics, where you really need to maintain those procedures, it would be better if we had some more refined way of maintaining the skills over the summer.
So this process works better for some subjects than others, perhaps?
That's true. We started using it in the middle school and high school in Columbia in mathematics, and it didn't work so well. And when we analyzed why, well, mathematics is one place where everybody knows you need to test all the time. You get problem sets, you do them in homework, you do them in class, you do them on the quizzes. So us adding another little quiz or two didn't do much. But in something like social studies or history or biology, it's quite different, that usually there isn't that much quizzing. So it didn't, our program, I think it works in math, it's just that it's already done. So what we did didn't add much to it.
Zoe, don't be nervous, by the way. I'm not going to ask you your opinion of extending the school year. You can think about it this summer and take it up with your teachers next year. How has this whole process worked for you, Zoe? I mean, has it changed? Has it really changed the way you learn to the point where it's something you notice?
It's helped so much with my studying. I've used it in other classes like English or math, definitely math. It's just, you know, it's helped so much because how Mrs. Bain taught it was, you know, you go through the questions and use the metacognition style, which is kind of like spacing almost. where you go through everything and you put a smiley face for all the stuff you know and a question mark for the stuff you don't know, and you go back and you check the question marks and you check the smiley faces and, you know, checked if they're correct, and it just helps so much. And it's, you know, it's probably going to be a style I'm probably going to use for the rest of my schooling time, especially for high school and college too. And it just helped me so much.
Okay, metacognition. Help me.
Metacognition refers to what we know about our own cognition. So, like, if I ask you right now, do you know the capital of Australia? You could give me a judgment saying, yes, I do, or no, I don't. And you could even rate the confidence and be pretty accurate. Actually, that's a bad example because people are bad at the capital of Australia. most people think it's Sydney, and it's actually Canberra. But the idea is, it's what do you know about your own metacognition, your own memory in this case. So this is really fundamental to students, because when they're studying, they can have the illusion that they know something well. You read a passage over and over, and you think, boy, I really have it because it seems so fluent. But then the question is, well, can you really answer a question about it? Until you know that, and you have to test yourself to find out, simply reading it over and over gives you the illusion that you really know it. But until you can demonstrate you know it, you haven't. And so Zoe's idea of putting by each question, you know, a smiley face if I know it and a question mark if I don't, that also, the other thing that quizzing does is it tells you what you know, and then it helps guide your future studies. You go back to restudy the material that you didn't know so well. So unless you test yourself, or unless your teacher does, you don't get this so-called metacognitive benefit, which is psychology jargon for saying, what do I know and what do I not know?
Zoe, how do you feel about all those quizzes?
I didn't, you know, in the beginning, I went up to Mrs. Bain. I'm like, Mrs. Bain, I'm frazzled. And she explained to me, this is to help you come time for the final exam. And it opened up my eyes, and you know, I used to study for it, and after that I really took my stuff home and I really reviewed it. I would do the metacognition style, and I'd go downstairs and I'd be like, Mom, can you please quiz me on this? And she would quiz me. I'd come to first hour, I'd take my pop quiz, and I was doing much better on my pop quizzes. I was making 8 out of 8s, and it really helped me for the reviewing, and come time for the final exam, I wasn't, you know, as cramming as most people were, and I felt confident about it, and it helped a lot. The pop quizzes really did help.
Even though there's no grade attached to that, I mean, it would seem to me that some incentive would be lost if you're not getting a grade for this.
The whole problem with like the grading thing is like it freaks people out, but I just didn't really worry about it being a grade. I just kind of used it as a studying skill and just a review.
And I tried, thanks Zoe, I also tried to incorporate that as a teaching style. That this is to help you identify what you know and what you don't know, and we are really using it as a tool versus something that's going into the grade book.
One of the things I've seen also in the information concerning this subject is that this is really an aid for teaching teachers how to teach.
Absolutely.
Explain that, if you would.
It's really not intuitive, like what we have talked before. So much of this is counterintuitive. But the research totally backs up that, and as a teacher too, you can have students who will come in and say, oh, I studied for 3 hours last night. I'm going to ace this test. And you will grade it, and oh my goodness, they bombed the test. So you start realizing where's the disconnect?
What did I do that caused this?
Right. And when you're able to help teach your students how to study and how to identify metacognition, they're not spending all their time studying on what they already know, but they identify what they don't know, and then that's what they study.
Do you find, you know, Zoe sounds like a very bright young lady.
Yes, she is.
And a very personable young lady too, by the way, Zoe. But is she an exception or exceptional, or are you finding the same kind of reaction that she's giving us with all of your students?
I pretty much find it with all of my students. An example I would like to give is fourth quarter. We study the U.S. and Illinois Constitution. It's a very high-stakes test students have to pass in order to go into high school. And I use spacing. I use metacognition. I use the frequent quizzing. And this was all students, all 185 of them. And at the final, which was 7 pages long, much rigor was in that test, 89.6% of the students got A's and B's. And I really attribute it to the methods that they used to study. The retrieval, the spacing, they did great.
Do you feel the same way, Zoe?
I felt like I did really good. I put 110% into it, and I got an A on it, and I was so happy. It was just, it was great.
Another of the things that that I've learned in researching this program is the fact that kids apparently are less anxious about mm-hmm. taking the tests that count, those being the tests for which they're graded. Zoe, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree to that, yes.
All right. And Professor?
Yes, we have actually collected data from the middle school project asking children all the way through. So when they start the program, we ask them about their test anxiety. And then we just keep measuring test anxiety. And we've done this now. I think we have something like 700 kids who have gone through it. And the great majority, about 80%, say that they feel that their anxiety has lessened. And almost nobody says it's gotten worse. Some people say it's about the same. I'm about as anxious as I used to be. But most people have the experience that Patrice just mentioned, that they feel better prepared. It's not like if you just have one big test every now and then, well, that's when you freeze and you get anxious. If it's just built into part of the everyday routine where you're being quizzed, and some of those same questions will be on the big, it's not that you don't have the big test, it's just you're better prepared for them and they make you less nervous. So it's testing. We've thought for too many years, certainly I thought growing up and even teaching in college for some years, tests are kind of, the only reason you have them, the thought was to measure what students are learning. They're kind of like a little dipstick you drop into the brain. And it gives you how much have students learned. Well, that's a perfectly valid use of giving tests, but the way we're recommending is make it part of the learning process for the reasons Patrice talked about, that it improves the students' knowledge of what they know and what they don't know, but also when they're retrieving, they are going to retain that information better. They will know about the Illinois and the U.S. Constitution better in years to come than they would had they not used those strategies. And I think that's the one thing we need to keep track of. Teachers tend to focus on, well, how's the student doing on the grade on my test? But what we're really hoping to do is to teach them things that they will be able to use throughout their lives. And so many of us have the experience of, oh, the Constitution. I remember I studied that in school. I wonder what's in it. This will help.
Zoe, is this process going to be followed in high school, or is this just something that's going on in the middle school at Columbia?
No, I'm definitely going to be doing this process in high school, but it's just because it helps so much. I'm taking a lot of AP classes next year, so I'll be studying all the high schoolers I talk to, like, study, 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 and I'm definitely going to be doing this process because, number one, it helped me so much, and it's a great lesson. And it's a great way, for just in general, just with anything.
Patrice, what about the teachers, though? The teachers have to be part of this equation in high school. Are they there?
I believe so. Dr. Roediger might even know that better than I do at this point.
Well, I think at Columbia Middle School and Columbia High School, we've been working there. We've had grants from the Department of Education to work in those two schools. And so teachers have heard us give presentations. Right now we're working on a manual that could be used by teachers anywhere. We're trying to make it relatively straightforward, relatively short, and so we will have this manual. The other thing to point out, which we do in the book, Make It Stick, is that these techniques work for most any kind of training. There's training in the military, there's training in sports, and we have many examples in the books, training in business, a salesperson who needs to know all about the products she's selling. So we have examples all through the book of how these techniques work, not just in education, important as that is, but how any time you have the task of, I need to master a body of knowledge, whether you're a neurosurgeon or you're a salesperson or you're a football coach and you're trying to get your team to know all of its plays, these techniques work in all those settings.
I'm at a point now where I have to take another break, but I just want to ask you very quickly before I do so. Does the technique or the process change as students get older, or is it very much the same for the younger student and the older student?
I think the basic idea is very much the same. I'm using it at Washington University in my undergraduate and graduate classes. I changed it a bit. I'll have them, instead of giving them multiple choice quizzes like Patrice has done, say, in sixth grade social studies, I'll give them little essays to write. But same idea of quizzing.
Same idea. I have to take a break. I'll come back and take some phone calls because we have some people who want to get into this conversation and some pretty interesting subjects at hand here. We'll do that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We're talking about teaching and memory and retaining and retrieving information that students have learned. Our subject today is with Professor Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University and co-author of the book, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. Patrice Bain is with us, social studies teacher at Columbia, Illinois Middle School, where this practice, as outlined by Dr. Roediger and his colleagues, has been put into place. And also with us from Columbia is student Zoe Haina. And Zoe, thank you so much for staying with us. I want to go to the phones, but you've been doing this for a number of years, Patrice. Has there been an opportunity to really track this at all, to see how effective it's been or see how grade scores have gone up, that sort of thing?
Well, we did this study and had a lot of data from the study that showed the great success of these methods. I then, for the next several years, kept my own data, and I would usually have 85-90% A's and B's, 95% A's and B's across the board, and I have all students.
So you're convinced that this is a technique?
Absolutely
that
convinced.
Works. A question here with regard to teaching colleges, Professor. What are the implications for this whole technique in teaching young people to be teachers?
I think I would hope this will work its way into education schools. Many education schools require a course called educational psychology. It does take a while for research that's coming out to find its way into textbooks and into teachers' lectures. So I wouldn't say this is widespread yet. But I'm hoping it will be in the future.
That's the whole point of this book,
right,
is to get it in the hands of teachers and students as well,
yes,
as I assume. Let's go to the phones and bring in some of our listeners. We'll start with Jeff, who's been waiting the longest. He's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you. And if I may, in addition to my question, I'd like to make a comment about grades as a reward.
Go ahead.
I think that probably one of the most important challenges for teachers is instilling into kids an excitement and love for learning itself, so that acquiring knowledge and understanding is its own reward, you know, in addition to whatever value the grades have.
And let's just get a response to that. I'd like to hear what the professor and Patrice have to say about that. It seems to me that the system we're talking about, if kids are successful at it, they're going to appreciate and enjoy learning more.
I totally agree. I agree with you, Jeff. When you grades should not be a threat that goes into the grade book. It should be, a tool that's used. But keeping your students engaged when they start feeling success, they want to keep that success going. And you really start to see an intrinsic motivation begin where they like learning. They're successful at it.
I think that's absolutely right, that when you give them what quizzing does is give them a chance to succeed. I should mention also that we always recommend in the quizzing that students get immediate feedback or very quick feedback, so that if they do say something wrong or they just blank out and miss it entirely, they're immediately corrected. And that seems to especially helpful for learning, is to get the feedback when they've missed something on the quiz.
Zoe, your take on that? Do you find that learning is more fun, et cetera?
Yeah, I find that learning is very fun, you know, especially, you know, with Mrs. Bain. She makes it fun. You know, she'll, with the for example, with the Constitution quiz, we had to learn all the articles, all seven articles. So she made it to where it was in, like, an acronym, like Ledge Sacker. And she, and that, those helped me so much. And then she would take, you know, like, the different amendments, and she would make them into, like, the First Amendment, which is freedom of speech and, like, religion, and she made it into raps. And it's just an easier way for us as students to remember it. And I remember being at the on the Constitution test, I remember, you know, the question, I think I had that question, and I just remember going, raps, religion, you know,
assembly,
petition, you know, all that stuff. And it helps so much, and I found it so much fun.
You know, for some of us, just remembering the acronym is enough of a challenge. I have to stop right there. Jeff, you had a question, too, when we took a little time after your comment.
Hello?
Yeah, Jeff, go ahead. You had a question as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you looked at flashcards as a retrieval technique? And if you have, how does it compare in effectiveness to other techniques?
Patrice?
Oh, absolutely. I encourage a lot of flashcards, and not only can students make them, there are several online flashcards that you can make that will have them come up randomly. I think that is a great way, and it also helps the students to identify which ones they know and which ones they need to have more work. It's important once they know them that they will continue to go over them, not take them out of the pile forever. But, yeah, flashcards are a very, very effective way.
There's something also about the visual aspect,
yes,
of learning that can be more effective than the hearing it. Right. Okay, back to the phones, and let's bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, IQ test scores have been rising faster than can be explained by evolution. Could this be because our tests cannot really measure the potential of a person?
Well, let's go to the professor for that one.
Yes. What you're referring to is called the Flynn effect, after a man in New Zealand who discovered that every time they norm the IQ test, they have to norm them up, which surprises people because we keep hearing about how we're all going down in terms of intelligence. And nobody knows exactly why this is happening. But over the last 100 years, IQs in most Western countries where it can be measured have definitely risen. And among the theories, I can't tell you why exactly it's happening, but among the theories are actually things that we normally think aren't so good, like television. Certainly radio, I think, is very helpful, since I'm on the radio.
Thank you for that.
And because these things challenge people, they make them think. And when you ask, well, what was life like 100 years ago when IQ tests were first introduced, it was not as what we call cognitively demanding. Now, just to get around in life, you have to know how to drive, how to operate your computer, how to operate your complicated computer that you carry in your pocket, call your cell phone. So there's just many more demands on cognition for us to succeed. So that's one idea of why, or several ideas of why IQ might be rising. It's probably somewhat unrelated to the kind of, that's testing, standardized testing, which is not the kind we're really fostering here. I don't have anything against standardized testing, but what we're proposing is that the quizzing techniques will help improve learning. But the standardized testing is a very interesting aspect, too, that you bring up.
Well, how does this work, or is it likely to work, with some of the new innovative methods that they're using in today's teaching world? Now, the Common Core is getting a lot of attention today and a lot of discussion.
Yes, there are a lot of computer programs. I get emails almost every week from people developing them where they're trying to use techniques like spacing and retrieval practice to have people learn and to put this somehow computers or make it on the web. And I think there's a lot of potential here. We're still in the very early days yet. Same thing is true with online education in general. I think my analogy is this is like the personal computer industry was in the early 1980s. There were 25 or 30 different companies vying for to be the best, and nobody knew at the time that Apple and IBM would be the ones that came out on top. I bought a computer called The Leading Edge, which the company folded a year later. But all my smart friends told me that was the way to go. I think we're doing that right now with online education. There are all these ideas out there, and some of them are going to work and some aren't, but it's too early to say which ones will yet.
But Patrice, how about, you know, this whole concept of teaching to this test and establishing certain standards that have to be met? I can't imagine that this would be a problem with any of that. Probably be helpful.
I think it's very helpful. Yeah. And you had brought up Common Core. I know Missouri's doing something a little different than Illinois. But the whole premise of it is to be able to get into subjects deeper and to be able to really discuss at a deeper level. And all of these strategies really help with that. You're able to identify the information. You know the information. And then you can, as a teacher, you can take these, just take your students farther and to higher levels of thinking.
Zoe, any thoughts from you on all of this?
You know, when it comes to standardized testing, you know, we don't really know. It's just kind of like, you guys got a standardized test today. And we're just like, oh, okay. Well, but with the whole standardized testing, it's just, it kind of helps me, you know, look into, like, the subject more. Whenever I have, you know, like the math one, for example, I'll look at a problem and I'll be like, do I know this? Do I not? And it just, you know, it just helps with the, it also helps with the aspect of what do I, it does help with the aspect of what do I know and what do I not and what do I need to learn more for me to, you know,
all right.
For the test.
Okay, good. We've got, let's go back to the phones and we'll take this call from Millstadt from Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a special ed teacher, and I, just listening to the conversation, it sounds to me like you have a rather pristine classes that you teach. I look at learning as being tactile, visual, or auditorial, and by the time the students get to me in middle school, many of them have given up. So it's my job to motivate them. And I run into what do I need to know this for? I can make $1,000 a week selling drugs. Also, adapting to their ability. I try to teach them how to retrieve the information they need from different sources as opposed to their memory. Any comments, please?
Thank you so much. Does this technique apply to special education students?
If I could say something real quick on that. Thanks for asking, Bob. I have all the special ed students. When I taught sixth grade, I had all of, if a student was in sixth grade, I had them regardless if they were in special ed or not. I actually conducted a study because I was so impressed with how well my students in special ed were doing. And so I was able to do a study based on how much they were able to retain before accommodations were used. And there was outstanding results. So I know that these recommendations work for special ed students as well.
Professor, is this a serendipitous discovery here?
No, that we don't have too much research yet with special education students, but we, to the extent that it has been studied, we have found it effective. We have a little trouble doing our studies in the classroom because the special education students naturally get a lot of practice outside of class that that we don't control. So, as Patrice said, though, in the special study she did, produced very good results.
Zoe, do you have any contact with special ed students and any feelings about how effective this is with them?
Well, you know, I do have some special ed kids who were in my class this year, and I felt like they were, and I actually sat by a few at my table, and I felt like they were doing well, you know, and I would talk to them, and I sometimes would help them, and, you know, they knew what they were doing, so I feel it does help
a
lot with them.
If they knew what they were doing, that's certainly a big part of the equation. We have an email here from Bruce I'd like to get to with time remaining. I was wondering if this book could help with memorization of quotes and complete recall of passages, etc., or is it more suited for comprehension and understanding? Professor?
It's really more suited for comprehension and understanding that I think it would help with the quotes, and retrieval practice is really what you really need for that. That in the schools often, certainly I did when I was growing up, I was required to memorize poetry. And certainly, memorizing poetry is retrieval practice. You can't do it any other way. If you just read it over and over, you'll never get the poem. But if you practice retrieving it and go back to it when you fall down and forget a verse or something, then you can. So I think the book would help for verbatim memory, but we're really hoping for deeper comprehension and learning. But I think it would help for both.
There's also a section in your book that talks about how an actor uses these and is able to take in roles. He knows all the parts, so he can step in at any time.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to get Alina into the conversation, but it has to be quick, Alina. Calling from St. Louis. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if these processes are as effective in students with dyslexia, ADHD, any kind of processing problems. If these processes are just as effective or less so, or there's a way to alter them for specific issues, learning problems.
Yeah, we have just not studied that very well yet, so I just can't answer that question very well. I would be hopeful that it would be, but I can't absolutely say. There have been studies of older adults with brain damage, and it has helped them, but I don't know if that would generalize to other kinds of disorders.
And I have found it to be successful in my classroom in that, as with all students, helping them identify what they know and what they don't, and coming up with the strategies, it works.
All right. We thank you, Alina, so much for the call. We have Tony in Wildwood wants to get into the program, but we don't have time, and he wants to ask if this will help with general memory. I think you missed the first part of the program, Professor, when you indicated that, yes, in fact, it does.
Yes. No, it helps with long-term retention, helps with general memory for facts over the long term.
Okay. In a few seconds left, anything you'd like to add very quickly about this?
No. I thank you for having us today and appreciate being here.
Patrice?
Thank you for having me as well, and thank you, Zoe. You made me smile.
Zoe, it's been a pleasure meeting you, and we wish you the best of luck, not only in the swimming competition this year, but as you embark on this next phase, high school. Oh, boy, you're looking forward to that, I'm sure.
I am, actually, and thank you so much for having me.
I'm sure you'll have a great career in high school and beyond that. Zoe Hannes, one of our guests on today's program. You've also been listening to Professor Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University, and the co-author of the book we've been talking about, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. Also with me in studio is Patrice Bain, social studies teacher at Columbia, Illinois Middle School, where the practices that outlined by Professor Roediger and his co-authors in that book has been put into practice and apparently working very successfully. Again, thank you all so much for being with us. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we're going to be talking about naturescaping and other things and other ideas for making our homes and our yards environmentally friendly. So be sure to be with us then. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.